The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2, there's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
Hello, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his court-appointed supervisor, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 25 of The Big Picture for the week beginning August 17. And coming up on today's show, fight, fight, fight. It's all fisticuffs over at The Big Picture with the release of boxing film Southpaw.
And we've even got a couple of hard-hitting fight songs from movies that you're going to want to fight onto.
And fighting of a different kind, The Family Holiday under the microscope with the release of Vacation. Well, there is just lots going on this week's edition of The Big Picture.
And them's fighting words.
Thank you. I thought we'd wait at least 5 minutes before we got the first cliche, but we're right out of the gate this morning.
Right out of the blocks.
As always, our goal is to give you an overview of the top pieces of pop culture that are shaping your world this week and help you see them from a Christian perspective. And there's plenty in the show to talk about and share with family and friends. Also coming up, my top five best road trip films.
Oh, nice one.
I'm looking forward to that. And we take a look at The Voice, and if your kids haven't got hooked yet, they probably should or will. It's probably like TV crack.
Well, kids don't do drugs, but do the voice.
Do the voice instead.
Apparently.
Well, I don't know.
We'll find out.
We'll weigh up if it's a good idea. As always, everything we do is on the Big Picture website, which used to have the incredibly annoying URL of...
Oh, the-big-picture.com.au. Annoying about that, Mark.
But now, thanks to our cameraman Consuela, we've actually got the much easier to remember home of thebigpicturewebsite.com.
Whoa.
How stunningly simple
is
that?
As in thebigpicturewebsite.com, all one word?
I cannot even make a joke out of it. It's that simple.
Thebigpicturewebsite.com. No, nice work.
All right,
moving from thebigpicturewebsite.com to The Big Picture Show. First out of the blocks this week in the Now Showing segment, we're going to be talking about Dancing with the Stars. It's something that, Mark, I reckon can definitely qualify as institutional television in Australia. Not as in like it's an institution.
It should be put into an institution.
But it's been around for so long. It's been going for 15 seasons. I repeat, 15. And Dancing with the Stars has carved its own niche into Australia's televisual landscape. And it's a niche that many might like to fill up with a bit of handy spack filler, possibly. But please, hold off on picking up your trowel. Because when something has had this much longevity, Mark, you've got to ask a question. I think you have to ask this one question. What is it that appeals so much to Australia's audiences? Why do they keep coming back? So I think if you can also hit an answer to this question, you're a lot closer to understanding the people that God has placed around you.
Last week.
It's my favourite show of the series.
The stars are sharing their special life moments.
I felt it. Everybody did. Very moving.
You're like a pocket rocket. Tricks and treats for everyone.
Well, that's what you call a transformation.
Damien, I think that was you.
I know.
And I just said... She's safe. She's dancing down the middle of the floor.
But
seriously.
Bennett has come with no dance experience.
That is your challenge, Carmelo.
No dance experience?
And here she is. Look, this format has been borrowed from the BBC's worldwide Dancing with the Stars franchise. So it's one of those ones that we kind of picked up overseas and went, maybe they'll do well here.
Maybe.
Lo and behold, as you said, 15 seasons later, it started in 2004 and we're still watching it now. And it's exactly what it promises. If those people who haven't seen Dancing with the Stars wonder what it's about, well, let me
tell us.
There are no global nebulas or anything like that involved. The show pairs celebrities with professional ballroom dancers who each week compete against each other on kind of a dance-off to impress a panel of judges and ultimately the viewing public. So this is kind of, votes via text, the usual sort of thing, plus what the judges have to say. Shane Bourne is one of the current sort of hosts. It's kind of like his own grandfather of television, I think, in Australia. Edwina Bartholomew, she's pairing off against him. And I'll admit that stars, Dancing with the Stars, is a somewhat loose term. Given we've got to the 15th season, and now what we're looking at is the sort of competitors from The Bachelor and people who are also on My Kitchen Rules. You know, or, I mean, the most famous person is probably in the current season is Larry Emder from The Morning Show. And that's okay. Former retired NRL players like Matt Rogers or things like that. You know, but the show is basically enjoyable because what you do is you end up seeing a whole new side to people. You know, these are people who you're known for one reason and they actually do surprise you. You wonder, they are put in a sort of a pressure cooker situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And most do surprise.
So do you reckon that's the fine point of the appeal of Dancing with the Stars? Has it got something to do with the fact that celebrities are up there doing their thing? We're a culture that's very fascinated with celebrities and getting any camera angle we can on them. Is that really where Dancing with the Stars finds its appeal with its audience?
Yeah, I think close. Close, but
oh,
no
I'm
cigar.
So close.
Ah. Look, this is definitely a show that appeals, and I love your intro because it's true. We really do have to ask ourselves. I mean, some people might be snooty and go, "Oh, Dancing with the Stars." This
yeah,
is
including myself. And when we talked about putting this segment on, I had to remind myself that loads and loads and loads of people watch this show. It's not necessarily for me. I think I've seen like one or two episodes, but the appeal of it can't be denied, and it's really, I'm glad you're investigating, because I'm very curious about trying to put a fine point on what exactly is the appeal.
When you talk about loads of people, you're actually talking about millions of Australians.
I was being very specific with my terminology,
yeah, loads. But let me give you a benchmark for people who are listening if you're wondering about how ratings work. Look, if you wanted to know what was the magic number in Australian television, it is 1 million. If you can crack 1 million, then given our audience size, you're basically, if you're getting a million people to tune in each week, then you've got a runaway success program.
You can write your own check. And light
so
cigars.
Dancing with the Stars has regularly posted over 2 million in Australia. Its highlights
throughout its whole 15
seasons.
This
is what I'm saying. Yeah, we are over the hump, so to speak. I mean, it has been going for 15 seasons, so literally at the moment it's more around the 700,000 mark. But the heady days of 2006, 2007.
Who can forget?
2.2 million per show.
Seriously.
I know, and I just don't get it. But I did think about this, and I was thinking to myself, you know what this is? Here's a phrase. I think this is RSL television. And
yeah? So it's not just trying to watch celebrities crumble in front of our eyes?
No.
Because I thought it might be one of those embarrassment shows where you might tune in to see someone like do Electric Boogaloo and do it really badly.
It's not like Celebrity Splash.
What was that?
Well, that was the Channel 7... I can't believe you missed it. But then again, it was so bad, you probably should have. Look, Celebrity Splash, they got a whole lot of celebrities and put them on diving boards and told them to jump off the television. You know, they didn't renew that for a second season.
I'm asleep already. But I so that wasn't obviously designed. So,
no, but
so you weren't expecting people to make a splash.
No.
Instead, you're expecting them to bomb.
That was tragedy. Very well
right.
played there.
Thank you.
No, I think... this one, actually, when I say RSL television, I'm harking back to an idea of vaudeville, okay? Like, there was a stage where in which entertainment involved people getting up on a stage and performing for a live audience, and live television came out of that. And so early television is very vaudevillian. It's got, like, you know, here's a bit of singing, and now here's a bit of dancing, and here's an
There were so many variety shows in the early day of
you
TV.
You got it. And this is harking back to that. But the key to those sorts of things is audience participation, is the feeling of community. So when you say, do we get to know these celebrities better? Well, the truth is we get to see them in a more rounder way. We get to feel like we know. We get that closeness of vaudeville television. Or it's not surprising to me that the key sponsors of Dancing with the Stars are actually a cruise line. Now, if you think about that, the same sort of entertainment you'd be seeing on Cruise Line is really playing through to that audience who would appreciate that and who are also now watching it on
So this
television.
Is unashamedly old school TV.
Very old school.
Jurek, is that a bad thing? Because often those of us who aren't fans of this kind of programming, such as myself, would look at this kind of show, Dancing with the Stars, and think, well, it's just this format they wheel out all the time. I don't really care. I want something new and fresh and original and reinventing the wheel, blah, 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 blah. And I look at it like I'm suggesting it's a bad thing, but is it?
Yeah, well, you're making me feel like I should say kids today. But really, look, I think there is an interesting thing that has happened philosophically, spiritually, you know, in our world, where we've taken the word unchanging and we've actually substituted stagnant. Okay, the idea that if something doesn't change, it's necessarily bad. If something is old, it's called dated now. Okay, is the idea that somehow things that the whole virtue of what is good is that it is new and it is changing and it is always up to date. Okay, and phrases like this actually shape the way we think about things. And so if you think about that in terms of television, yeah, we look at these formats and we go, they're old or they're dated, so we don't like them. They can't be any good. But the truth is, millions of people do enjoy them. Okay, so what actually does that, how does that actually affect our world? Well, if you start looking at philosophy or the way you see the world or God as a concept, it's so old, it's so outdated, it's so, well, centuries ago, primitive, you'd hear people say, as if the idea that just because something was established and popular a long time ago, it can't be right or real now, is ridiculous. Because when you think about it, if something is true, it doesn't really matter if it was true a century ago or true 5 minutes ago. It's true. It's true.
And I realised something that you said earlier about Dancing with the Stars.
I'm glad there was something.
I don't think I'm necessarily going to go and watch it, but you said that there's like a communal aspect to this show.
Yeah.
That I don't know if a lot of other TV shows actually do that, inspire community.
There is a solid core to this show that is not going away in a hurry. And so I think we've got to remember to ourselves that when we evaluate something, whether it be TV or whether it be religion, you can't actually lean on the fact that just because it happened a long time ago doesn't mean it's a bad idea. You know, and that's something well worth remembering, especially when you look at Dancing with the Stars.
Dancing with the Stars airs nationally on the 7 Network. It's on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. It's rated PG. And certainly some of those dance routines, as far as I understand, Mark, on Dancing with the Stars, might need a little bit of parental guidance and a little bit of explanation to the kids about why these people, who often are married, the stars that are on there, often are married and the other dance partners are married, but yet they're not dancing with their spouse.
Yes, I would just if I'd be telling the kids that they're all married, it's all fine.
Oh, okay, so just lie straight to the kids, sure.
Yeah. There was my parenting unmasked. This week's big release is Southpaw, because what the world really, 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 really needed right now was another drama about a boxer who faces troubles in and out of the ring.
And we definitely needed that at cinemas everywhere. Yes, we did.
So hoping to follow in the golden gloves of The Champ, Rocky, or Million Dollar Baby, Southpaw stars Jake Gyllenhaal as a buff pugilist knocked to the canvas by a
pugilist. That is a fantastic word.
And should get used more.
Yeah, it means boxer.
Buff pugilist, did I say that?
Yeah.
Knocked to the canvas by a horrific tragedy, getting his pugilistic life together. Sorry, I'm just trying to help you out now. Of course, involves training montages and a wise, mysterious mentor played by Forest Whitaker. So how does Southpaw go? Does it have any new moves? Ben stepped into the ring with Southpaw and discovered it lands some different punches, especially when it comes to individual glory and whether it's actually possible to train so hard that you can control everything in your life.
I put my family through a lot.
The harder you fight, I get it.
Let's go!
Only now you've taken way too many hits before you get off.
You can't fight like that anymore.
Think about her.
I'm gonna tell you something.
I love you.
I love you.
So predictable.
Man.
The light heavyweight champion of the world, Billy Curry.
I wouldn't be here without my wife, Maureen.
Hey, Billy, why are you leaving so soon?
Come on, keep walking.
Baby, you ain't never been a real man.
Let that go.
Let's go home.
How about I take your belt?
Hey, stop!
Who took me in the eye? No, 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 no! No, no, no!
Why did I just hear in my head, Adrian? Sorry.
Because you can't not think of quotes from Rocky whenever a new boxing film shows up. As you mentioned, Jake Gyllenhaal is in this as the excellently named Billy Hope. Billy Hope is this fighter.
I bet the person who actually wrote that story said, what a happy fortuitous moment that this character is already called Hope and I don't have to make that connection.
And
you
get so many hashtags towards the end of the movie about Hope wins and all that kind of stuff. Billy Hope is this prize fighter who is an orphan from New York, the mean streets, and he's risen up to be at the top of his game when it comes to the boxing ring. As the clip just demonstrated, though, from what we just played, there's a bit of strife. Actually, that's a really polite term for an epic tragedy that befalls the Hope family. And unfortunately, I think the trailer gives this away, and I don't want to give away what actually happens. It's a big catalyst for what goes on in Southpaw and it really shapes what happens in the second half of the film. And as you could probably guess, because it's a boxing movie, it's going to be a rags-to-riches kind of story.
Why do we keep going there? Right? I mean, like, it seems like there is only one arc to a boxing film. Okay, and that is boxer had could have been a champion. Had almost went there, didn't, but now he's going to climb the mountain all over again.
And why probably will that? Get there in the end. Yeah. One of the
unless he's Rocky and he has to wait three films before he actually gets there.
One of the novel things about Southpaw, if you can call it that, is it starts at the top. So Billy Hope is winning from the kickoff. He's had like 43 fights and no defeats, and he's got this great loving marriage with his wife Maureen, played by Rachel McAdams. One of the best things about Southpaw, I thought, was the way that his wife is depicted and the relationship the two of them have, and she is a huge force behind his career, and he actually recognizes that and celebrates his wife. It's a really like quite loving portrait of a relationship in this family. The rags to riches story, though, so we get pretty much riches to rags, and why that happens I really don't want to go into. But then the trajectory back towards the riches, again, is like the usual boxing template. Why it turns up in boxing stories, I think, is because a boxer is usually represented in films, whether it be Million Dollar Baby or Rocky or whatever it is, as a person who doesn't necessarily have anything else going for them apart from they can beat people senseless in the ring. And
maybe that they're prepared to even climb into the ring.
That's right. Also got the discipline and the regimen to go forward and try to win in the ring at this particular effort. And so you get this individual endeavor story where you can funnel all of a lot of people's many dreams about being an individual, being able to succeed and doing it on your own terms. And even if you don't have much going from you, no matter where you've come from, and like Billy Hope in Southpaw, you've come from the mean streets, from an orphanage, you can succeed by battling your way through on your own terms, on your own strength. And I think that's why the rags to riches template continues to be put on the top of boxing films, and why Southpaw uses it quite well. And I did.
Do you like it?
I liked it enough. It does still suffer from the predictability of a boxing movie, the rise and fall. That even if you're going from the riches to the rags, back towards the riches, I don't want to try to give away the ending, but you know, you can probably guess where it's going. And even by the
is
time,
is there a fight? Like an ultimate fight? Please let there be an ultimate
and
fight.
And is it a fight where vengeance is going underneath it?
Would there be? Is there emotional tension off the screen, even as they're having the fight?
Yes, Mark. Yes, there is.
It's everything I hope for in a boxing film.
And look, it is still a story about individual triumph to some degree, and that's what a lot of boxing films present, that you're focused on this fighter. But one of the things I did like about the film, as I mentioned earlier, was the relationship that Billy Hope has with his wife, and how it's demonstrated that there are other people assisting these fighters in doing their thing, and that they couldn't do it without these people. So as much as Southpaw, Rocky, Million Dollar Baby, any other boxing film you can list, usually they get emphasized for the individual triumph in the film. Southpaw demonstrates very nicely that other people are involved. And in the second half of the film, a mentor figure comes in, a little bit like Clint Eastwood's role in Million Dollar Baby, or Adrian in Rocky, this wizened old figure who's a little bit mysterious, a little bit cranky, tells it like it is. Forrest Whitaker plays that character, this boxing trainer in Southpaw. And as much as at times it gets a little bit hard to swallow that he says all these really point-blank statements to Billy Hope about getting his life in order and thinking things through, Forrest Whitaker is excellent, and he can really convey the strength of that. But again,
he's kind of the Yoda of the boxing.
He is the kind of Yoda of the boxing round. But one of the more enjoyable things about Southpaw, while you're getting past the predictability and the when are they next going to step in the ring? When are they going to have the next training montage? As you're banishing that to the back of your mind, one of the things I really enjoyed about it was the fact that other people around the boxer are celebrated for how they input into this person's quest for victory.
Okay, look, you mentioned before that they basically these films have one of those sort of standard plays, the drive of discipline, the sequences that will take them up to the point. I've often wondered about this because in boxing films, this self-motivated discipline pays off in the end. But what if, in the real world, if a sportsman spends all their time completely devoted to doing something, they do it, they arrive the day before the event, they break their big toe, or they kick the fridge, or the cat jumps on them, scratches their eye, or something like that, and it all falls apart. Does the film give any idea about how to cope when the dream doesn't arrive?
It does. One of the strongest things about Southpaw is there's more on the dramatic front than there is on the sporting. There's a lot of sporting scenes, and I should have mentioned they're very hard-hitting, which you expect from a boxing movie, right? Like, you expect loads of violence and bloodshed. That definitely happens in Southpaw, so there's a word of warning about that. One of the stronger elements of Southpaw, though, is dramatic core, and it does show Billy Hope trying to cope with life, particularly when it plummets and goes really, really far downhill. One of the issues that arises, apart from the family tragedy that happens in the second half of the film, there's other factors that come into play that demonstrate that none of us can control what's going on. And Forrest Whitaker's mentor, Yoda character, has this great scene where he actively admits that
a big guy, he could have eaten Yoda.
Instead of doing that, though, what he goes on to talk about is saying that he's a guy who coaches people in effectively living out their dreams and saying you can do anything and you can control your destiny and master it all and have all of this. And he actually admits on screen that you can't do that.
Oh, that is cool.
Which is amazing. Yeah, which is an amazing recognition. So further to your point about in the real world, when you are training so hard or you're so disciplined or you're so focused on a particular thing, Southport is a good wake-up call, I think, if you're living your life that way, to really consider, is that actually true? Can you control things to the furthest extent? We're in a world where God's over everything. God's in control. As far as I can understand, nobody else on this planet has anything like the control that God exercises, and we see that on a daily basis. So one of the good things out of Southport for me, beyond the predictability, beyond the training montages, beyond the familiarity, which gets a little bit draining, one of the really cool things about it was this great reminder that we're not in control, even though, sure, towards the end, it may suggest that you can control your destiny a little bit more than I think the film should allow. Mm-hmm. It's a really good real-life reminder for someone like me who's a new father, daughter's 6 months old. There is a lot of things about her you cannot control, no matter how hard you try, no matter how hard you work at it.
No matter how many manuals you read and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so I came out, wanting to, train and get buff and stuff out of Southport, but I also came out thinking, I can't control everything, Mark.
Including your buffness.
Okay. Very true. So okay. Southport's at cinemas now.
It releases nationally this Thursday.
Yeah.
Yep. So August 20th stars Jake Gyllenhaal, Rachel McAdams and Forest Whitaker. Rated MA 15+.
Surprise.
Yep, no surprise really. The strong violence and coarse language, that's just par for the course for these sort of films. As much as anyone who has seen a boxing movie knows what to expect, Southport hits hard, it's bloody, it hits often, most of it's contained inside the ring. And look, go and check it out and see what Ben has to say.
Makes for a reasonable drama. Now, that triggered us thinking about our soundtrack choice for this week, Mark.
Where could we possibly go?
Where could we possibly go?
Boxing films.
And so, of course, we went here. Should know that that's the theme from the first Rocky film. It was composed by Bill Conti. That song's actually called Gonna Fly Now and is performed by Dieter Little, Mark, because the song actually has lyrics, which I think most people forget. Majority of people would remember that first appeared in the Rocky films during one of the many training montages where Sylvester Stallone's character, Rocky, is running through Philadelphia and then ends up ascending.
Going up the stairs
at the kids Philadelphia Museum of Art. And the significance of the ascension of the stairs is very well captured in the lyrics to Gonna Fly Now. There are 30 words in the lyrics to Gonna Fly Now, Mark, because there are actual words going on in the background. And those words are words like trying hard now, getting strong now, gonna fly now. So I don't think any other words could better encapsulate a boxing montage in a movie than those for Gonna Fly Now. And that's why we chose it in soundtrack for our first choice of fighting music this week. And another corker is coming up later in the show.
Looking forward to it. Okay, well, perhaps like Ben, your reaction was mixed when you heard that a new version of the seemingly never-ending National Lampoon's Vacation franchise was coming out.
Yes, my reaction was mixed.
Released at cinemas from Thursday, August 20, the newest Vacation stars the officers Ed Helms as the grown-up son of Clark Griswold, the original Vacationer played by Chevy Chase. Now, perhaps like Ben, you can see Helms making a fist of Vacation. He's a
sure
pretty
can.
Funny bloke, after
yes,
all.
Yes, he is.
But you don't really know why Helms, Australia's own Chris Hemsworth and others, had to make what looks like a remake of the original 1983 Vacation.
I don't understand, Mark.
Why? It was so good. Why redo that? Let's repaint the Mona Lisa while we're at it. Perhaps, like Ben, that first cross-country comedy about the Griswold family on the holiday from a not-so-nice place holds such a dear place in your heart that you wanted to reminisce about it with your family members. Perhaps that was your first intimation.
That must have been your first thought, surely.
Isn't that what everybody did? And also, who took that Vacation movie journey with you back in the day?
That's exactly what my family did with me.
So this week, Ben arranged a family reunion via Skype.
Sure did.
Because he never talks to his family, and this was as good an excuse as any. Yeah. With his parents and his twin brother and his younger sister to look back at why Chevy Chase's Vacation had an impact on them at all. And was it just Ben?
Maybe it was just me.
Or why certain movies might actually appeal to certain families.
Thank you very much for joining me on The Big Picture, Mum. That's Gaynor.
Hello, Ben.
Dad,
nice to
Jeff.
G'day there, Ben.
Twin brother, Ryan.
G'day, how you going?
And younger sister, Jess, by 6 years.
Hello.
Now, the reason I've gathered you all here today on The Big Picture is because finally I wanted to tell you the damage that was done to me as a 10-year-old by the present that you gave me at Christmas. Now, that's a joke. Thank you, Jess. That's a joke. Jeepers. Wow, tough crowd.
Right here.
My own family is a tough crowd. No, I've gathered
now,
you.
As parents, Ben, we take those things seriously.
Yeah. All right, Mum. All right. I'll get to the serious reason of why you're gathered here today. It's to talk about the seriously funny movie National Lampoon's Vacation. There's a new Vacation movie that's come out, but I wanted to let the people know that are listening to The Big Picture about how the original National Lampoon's Vacation film impacted me and my family. So, Mum and Dad, if you can recall, do you know when we as a family first started to watch this movie?
Not precisely, Ben. The question I perhaps would pose to you is, did you see it at someone else's house before you saw it at our house?
What could you possibly mean, Dad?
Yes, what could you possibly mean?
Was it M-rated, Jess? Why are you raising an M-rating, Jess? What would you like to tell people, Mum and Dad, about the system of us watching movies at home?
Well, seeing that I was the keeper of the videos in those days, I had a very harsh regime, which has scarred Ben deeply, where PG, we had to make sure it was PG before you watched, an M was certainly not seen before you were 15.
That is true.
I didn't even get to watch Forrest Gump when I was 14 and three quarters,
It wasn't just me that was scarred, Mum. It was Jess as well. But I am proof, everybody, that you can still follow your dreams and become a film reviewer, even if your parents inflict on you a harsh regime of not being able to watch M-rated films till you're 15. Which, Mum and Dad, in your defence, I understand why you did that, and you made a very sensible choice. So we must have started watching.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
Ben, no worries. We must have started watching.
You
must have
started watching. Very good, Ben. Cheers to that.
I will just weigh in and say that as the other twin, I didn't really care that much about it, but thanks anyway for the parenting.
Okay, right. Now moving on to National Lampoon's Vacation, right? So let's just say we started watching it after we were 15, and this is the one movie I can remember where our family gathered around and laughed as a collective. Is that your memories of it? That's what I think.
Yeah, pretty much. I remember, sitting around and watching it several times and laughing every time, and when I watch it again these days, I still laugh. So
I heartily agree with you, Ryan. Mum and Dad, what do you think?
Yes, I can still recall various parts we did all chuckle about, and I've got to say, though, perhaps in on reflection, it was a somewhat sadistic movie in some parts.
What do you mean?
Well, where the dog chain was dragging behind the car, but not the dog. Grandma on the roof.
Oh, yeah. Nana on the roof, yeah.
That's right. Brain man was, with a sandwich.
Oh, the sandwich. See, that sandwich scene in the movie is the funniest thing I think there is, when Chevy Chase, the lead character playing the dad of Clark Griswold, dancing with a sandwich and then realizes there's dog wee on it. I think that's the funniest thing about it. We should also point out for people listening to this podcast, we're not trying to advocate that everyone runs out and sees National Lampoon's Vacation. As we just pointed out, some of the humor's pretty dark. So I'm not quite sure why it appealed to us so much then. We were a family that, similar to the Griswolds in the movie, went on a lot of camping holidays, a lot of road trips when we were younger. Do you think that's some of the appeal?
I don't think our road trips are anything like theirs, though. Ours are usually a bit more successful.
Thank you for clarifying that, Jess.
We did actually manage to bust the back window from a stone coming off a camper one time, and we drove for another 100 km before we realised it was broken. So I reckon we were pretty close in a couple of instances.
There's a similarity, Ryan, that I'd forgotten about. That's exactly right.
That is proof that there should have been a National Lampoon's McKechnie Vacation. Jess, what about you? You're 6 years younger than Ryan and I. You've got any memories of National Lampoon's Vacation? Are they as strong as they are with Ryan and I?
I don't think as strong. I think for me, all of the National Lampoons sort of blend in together, but I can certainly remember funny bits. I think that the reason we all liked it, though, is that it was just so stupid, it was funny. Like, you couldn't not laugh. The Chevy Chase character was great, because Clark was just such an idiot. Like, you had to laugh at him.
That's a great one-sentence review, Jess. Now, to finish this off, family, and thanks again for joining me. Talking about family movies and the impact that National Lampoon's Vacation had on us got me thinking about, there's got to be loads of families out there that certain movies appeal to certain families. And I'm interested in your thoughts of why you think that might be the case.
You start, Jeff.
No, I was going to say, I think you'd have to be lucky to find a movie that the whole family could agree on, except if you had particular interests. And Mum would go into that.
Yeah, if you had particular interests, like if you're all interested in horses, or you're all interested in car races or something like that, that you've got a film that everybody could really get with. We as a family have such diverse interests in different films that we're very fortunate to find one, I think.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Ryan and Jess, what do you reckon?
Oh, well, I know that, just these films, again, like, they've gone another generation, because I've sat with my own kids and watched it, and we've all laughed, and we'll watch them over again.
You are the future of this country, Ryan.
I mean, Christmas Vacation comes out every year. You read The Night Before Christmas and you watch the Griswold's Christmas and laugh both.
Awesome. Jess, what do you think?
Well, humour, I think, can bring everyone together. But also, I think that's the way that some films are constructed, that they appeal to the kids and the adults. I think that's probably another part of it, that there was stuff that I wouldn't have got as the younger one, but all of you would have been laughing, your heads off because of whatever the joke was.
I'm still laughing about National Lampoon's Vacation.
I'm laughing because there's actually a saying on the news side of my industry that the first people you sell out are your family.
I didn't sell them down the river. I kind of did, actually. It made our family look like we just have this really dark sense of humour, which we don't.
Well, the Griswolds from South Australia.
And my family also pointed out to me after I recorded all that, they go, why don't you talk about Uncle Buck or Blues Brothers or The Castle that we all really enjoyed? Maybe because I really like National Lampoon's Vacation. Hey, and this is my show with you.
My show,
so I'm going to tell you what to do.
Yeah, take that, Mum. Okay. Vacation will be at cinemas from Thursday, August 20th. It stars Ed Helms, Christina Applegate and Thor.
Yep, Chris Hemsworth.
Rated MA15+ for strong nudity and coarse language. Oh, well, it's less family than we thought. Yes, Ben's mum, Gaynor, must definitely will not be seeing
this. She will not
Most
be seeing
definitely,
it.
No, not happening. Actually, in the August edition of Eternity, so coming up in Eternity, there is actually a review on Vacation by our own Ben. The new sequel to the National Lampoon's Vacation series. Ben's asking, look, is it old-fashioned to want to spend time together as a family? Should it even be encouraged? And how does Christianity impact on the idea of
family? That's one of the good things
holidays
about the National Lampoon's Vacation films, is that there's a real strong sense of family and togetherness. And I wanted to celebrate that.
Let us. Also on Eternity, actually, if you look at Eternity online right now, you can actually go over to the site. Last Thursday, the Australian Christian Book of the Year was announced, and Eternity reports on the winner and takes a look at the book Bible, the book itself. So well worth checking that out, biblesociety.org.au. Well, this week in our top five, we've had Ben regale us with the tales of his own family vacations, and I'm sure that stirred up a lot of memories for all of us, like family trips to Bungonia Gorge during heatwaves, and why no one should...
You just made that up.
And why no one should ever visit Wombeyan Caves in the winter. Yes, I'm talking to you, Dad. But... putting such personal scarring, never-to-be-forgotten, constantly-repeated incidents aside, we figured the release of Vacation would be reason enough to take a look at the holiday Hollywood style. Head on down the road with us as we take a look at what I think qualify as the top five best road trip movies ever.
Five.
I will not go anywhere unless I first note Planes, Trains and Automobiles.
Ah, well played. 1987. Straight out of the box.
There you go. Steve Martin plays Neil Page, a man whose flight gets cancelled on the verge of Thanksgiving and has to struggle through a whole gambit of travel modes to get home with an obnoxious slob of a shower curtain ring salesman played by John Candy.
But he's also really likeable and charming.
He is. He's got a constant companion through it. Sort of like the likeable, charming companion you couldn't get rid of with a gun. Okay, so he's just a lovely, lovely guy, far too lovely to be put up with over long distances. It's the most awkward road trip ever. It's designed and it gives birth to the memorable line, "They're not pillows."
I was just thinking that, Mark. I was just thinking that.
Let the reader understand if you haven't actually seen that film, but it's reason enough to go see
it. They really aren't pillows.
I know. Remarkable good fun decades after its release and the pattern for many, many road trip comedies to follow. But... I can't get away from this. This film from 1977 as a road trip film basically created its own mini genre. Smokey and the Bandit.
Okay. Oh, I'm really glad you went there.
I know, because the road trip has often become a road race, and Smokey and the Bandit set the format for things like, well, Cannonball Run and Convoy, and have actually, you know, it's got its antecedents in things like The Great Race, which came out in 1965. So you've incidentally got this whole idea of films that basically are road trip races, you know, and they're fun along the way as we find things. Well, Smokey and the Bandit's hired on a run to, as a contractor to basically get a tractor trailer full of beer over county lines while he's in hot pursuit by a pesky sheriff. And again, like this whole idea of characters becoming spawned by films and getting on a life of their own, the whole idea of the southern pesky sheriff just gave birth to a whole lot of other characters.
Yeah, even though the sheriff's just trying to do his job and the bandit played by Burt Reynolds is actually doing something highly illegal.
And Jackie Gleason gave birth to this idea of this character, this redneck cop that became the model for American chefs, sheriffs in James Bond and the Dukes of Hazzard and the Simpsons. It is rated B for brilliant, and I think it's well worth a place in our top five, as is...
Three.
Now, I'm coming right closer to the present now. The Trip from 2010. Okay, if you have not seen this film with British actor Steve Coogan and comedian Rob Brydon, you really got to see it. Okay, this is just funny. Basically, what happens is Steve Coogan he's playing himself. He's been asked by The Observer to tour the country's finest restaurants, but his girlfriend backs out at the last moment, and he's got to find somebody to go with him. So he takes his friend, you know, an eternal aggravation, actually, the comedian Rob Brydon.
And they're sort of playing versions of themselves, aren't they?
They are, basically.
It's a strange mix of fact and fiction, this
movie.
So
you get this real feeling of actual road trip you can imagine.
Yes. Like it is yes. Just like the highs and the lows.
It contains so many real life tensions, like who gets what room? And are you going to play that music? And don't you want me to drive? You know, all those sort of things that we experience on road trips ourselves, but they turn into some really funny things. It's also a very clever look at aging. You see these guys who are going off to a road trip that probably would have been much more fun and frantic and frivolous 20 years earlier, and now they're worried about whether or not this mattress will actually give them a backache for the night. You know, so it is great fun. Steve and Rob actually have some fantastic moments, and it's well worth seeing if only for one scene as they're driving
along. Michael Caine?
No, the Michael Caine,
so their impressions of Michael Caine are fantastic
of Michael
over
Caine
dinner.
Are fantastic.
That's
not the scene. It's the one where they start talking randomly about what it would have been like to be a Scottish lord back in the days heading off before breakfast. I laughed too much in that particular one, as I did all the way through my next choice.
Two.
there are a lot of post-apocalyptic road trips worth considering, like The Road, and some you'd like to forget, like The Postman. Okay, so...
Poor old Postman.
I'm just saying. But my favourite for the end of civilization road trip has to be Zombieland from 2009.
Splendid choice.
It is incredible. A shy student trying to reach his family in Ohio.
Played by Jesse Eisenberg.
A gun-toting tough guy trying to find that last Twinkie.
Played by Woody Harrelson.
And a pair of sisters trying to get an amusement park, get to an amusement park called Pacific Playland, basically join forces to travel across zombie-filled America. Now, I love this film, if only because of, amongst many things, for the laughable way it shows how humanity surviving the zombie apocalypse still clings to little things to sort of make life normal, not the least of which is Eisenberg or Columbus's list of rules for surviving Zombieland. It's very creative. Cardio. One must remember cardio at all points. One must always beware of bathrooms. And the all-important, don't be stingy with your bullets. Always use the double tap, okay, if you're going to take care of yourself in Zombieland. But most importantly, on the human side of the equation, though, it's the way that we hang on to those simple human pleasures in the midst of the most inhuman situations, which is why we're off to Pacific Playland. And that takes us to my favourite road trip film of all time.
Can't possibly wait. Tell us.
You did wait.
Oh, yeah, I guess I did. Yeah, I don't know why I even bring that up. Tell us.
In 1980, Jake Blues, out of prison, puts together his old band to save the Catholic home where he and his brother Elwood were raised. Yes, I'm talking about the Blues Brothers.
Oh, yes, you are.
It's a fantastic film. Now, in preparing this list, I realised that I have children who have not seen this film. And this will be remedied this weekend as I go out and buy a Blu-ray copy.
That is my brother's favourite film.
It's an incredible film. It's fantastic. Basically, it devolves into a road trip across America to pay the back taxes on this home that they grew up in and causing mayhem for cowboys, cops, and assorted Nazis along the way. It's so much to love. 103 cars were wrecked in the filming of this movie, which was actually a world record that stood for ages. And the Bluesmobile itself does this one scene where it travels 118 miles an hour under the elevated train line. Now, I just want to say, there are people standing in this shot, and you've got to remember, we are pre-digital. So when these people throw themselves out of the way in terror, it's probably because they're going to die if they don't play their roles well. We had only the Blues Brothers soundtrack. When I was growing up, we had only the Blues Brothers soundtrack on a two-week camp that I went on as a teenager, and we didn't consider that a problem.
No, you would not be disappointed.
We just listened to it ad nauseum.
And Dan Aykroyd and Jim Belushi in this film, the John Landis director, that Dan Aykroyd and Jim Belushi together in this film were fantastic as brothers on the road.
There's this great little story about Jim Belushi, actually. He disappeared halfway during the filming, during one night scene, and Dan Aykroyd went looking for him, and he looked around because they're an open countryside, you know, in the US, and he saw in the distance one house with a light on. It was like 3 a.m. So he walked over the house because they're looking around. The whole cast is around. The crew are looking for John Belushi. And he knocks on the door. He says, he's preparing to say, look, you know, we're looking for John Belushi. The door opens and the owner says, you're looking for John Belushi, aren't you? And John Belushi had gone up, knocked on the door and said, could I have a glass of milk and a sandwich, please? To this guy, woke him up in the middle of the night, had the sandwich and then went to sleep on his couch. You know, to which Dan Aykroyd then gave him the nickname America's Guest. You know, this is just turn up anywhere, get me a sandwich.
They should have put that in the movie.
This was a great film for me. And as I said before, like it's one that sort of punctuates me growing up. And I remember seeing it on Christian camps and things like that, because despite the occasional coarse bit of language in the Blues Brothers, it became a legendary movie for what it means to go all out for something you believe in. And suddenly, for a bunch of teens, we're on a mission from God became a really cool catchphrase. I love this film.
You better get bright, pal. We got a show to do. Then we got to figure out some way to collect that gate money. Get it to the Cook County Assessor's Office as soon as they open in the morning.
Joliet, Jake, and Elwood Blues. Two men with a mission. And only 11 days.
Don't come back until you've redeemed yourselves.
Our Lady of Blessed Acceleration, don't fail me now.
Beat! Heal it! Cut!
don't understand it. We're on a mission from God.
Apologies to my own Blues brother, Ryan, who loves the Blues Brothers, and I just said Jim Belushi is in that film, but I'm glad you stepped in and said John Belushi is. And also, I think you should have mentioned the fact that they scream through a mall, they drive through a mall in the Blues Brothers, and there are people in that.
And again, and that's that, you'll see these scenes are amazing, and just look, tune in if only to see this incredible, crazy, inverted car dropping from the sky scene that is
so good,
phenomenal.
Wow, that's a great top five list. Moving on to our second soundtrack choice for the show. At the top of the show, we played some fighting music. We played Gonna Fly Now from Rocky. Here's our second fighting music choice.
Stop.
Mark, that is Where Is My Mind, performed by the Pixies, and that's taken from the final scene of Fight Club, a great David Fincher film starred Brad Pitt and Edward Norton. This excellent movie that was about the erosion of masculine identity and then where it can be resurrected, where you can find kind of the primal heart beating of aggressive manliness, and it was done in such a way that it all kind of pummeled itself in the fight clubs that Brad Pitt and Edward Norton were in.
And who honestly didn't go out and form their own fight club in their basement after that?
Me, for one. But why I chose this song, Where Is My Mind, that one line itself, Where Is My Mind, was a fantastic encapsulation of so much about Fight Club, and the fact that it was at the end when, without trying to give it away, Where Is My Mind, I think in four words, encapsulates the entirety of Fight Club.
This is a twist film. It's really worth seeing.
Mark, if you were with us earlier in the show, which I believe you were.
I remember something about it.
Yeah, we talked about one format show that's on air at the moment, Dancing with the Stars, and it's been raking in millions of viewers for the 7 Network for more than a decade. Now, such huge numbers have now been taken over by the singing sensation that's on the small screen, The Voice. In 2012 alone, The Voice delivered an average of, wait for it, 2.5 million viewers to the 9 Network.
Yeah, per show.
Jeepers. It was back again in 2013 with an average of 2 million per program. Oh, just 2 million this time. And yet another 1.8 million per show.
A paltry 1.8.
Wow, it's on the slide. I can't believe it. The ratings are pretty consistent for 2015, so it's made for an excellent choice for our show in the What Your Kids Are Watching segment, because we know the kids are watching it, and you know they're watching it because you're probably watching it with them. Now, what's the formula for success that The Voice has cracked? I hear you ask that question, Mark. Well, seems that The Voice has cracked the formula of selling the dream that a normal guy or girl can be the sound that makes Australia, maybe the world, sit up and listen.
You're 16. It's very impressive. Very impressive.
People need to hear what you're saying, not only in Australia, around the world.
I'm telling you right now, all the girls in Australia are going to freak out over you.
I love your voice.
Do
be free, and I felt that.
Wow!
Thank you so much for what you just did. It was just real, man. It was raw.
I can't take him seriously. Ricky, it's so real, man. You're
Ricky
so
Martin,
real.
One of the judges on the show.
He is indeed. Listen, I've got a confession to make right up front.
Oh, confession.
Here. Okay, The Voice, it was one of those programs that I, as a matter of course, had to watch as a TV reveal, and then we got hooked, or at least more to the point, I got hooked. And then
did you?
Then got the family hooked. So
Dancing with the Stars, not so much. You could see in it, but you actually liked The Voice.
We sat down with The Voice, and we're like...
Your family?
Well, we're four seasons down. So, yeah, like, I mean, and that's...
You are in.
We're trying to get out. There's rehab. There's all sorts of things. But look, no, The Voice is one of those compelling programs which parents discover they can watch with their kids. And they don't mind their kids sort of getting into. It's one of those models that are really sort of... is kind of, I hesitate to use the word wholesome. You know, the kids are singing along with it.
Some of the song choices wouldn't be applicable for all the family. And even some of the outfits that might be worn on the show might be
generally speaking,
a little bit questionable, maybe.
Well, generally speaking, they've got a good eye on their PG audience.
Okay,
so they're watching their time frame. It's a 7 o'clock show, okay, on a Sunday. So it even works with bedtime, so to speak. You know, you let the kids watch something and then they're heading off to Bible study in bed and that sort of stuff.
You actually sound a little bit excited about this show. What is it about it that you like?
I think the big issue for The Voice, which separated me, now I put my professional hat back on account of the fact that I have no hair and my head's getting cold. The big professional, you know, like for me is that it changed the model of talent show. So I don't know if you actually understand how talent shows work beforehand, but generally speaking, it was an us and them sort of situation.
Like Australian Idol.
Yeah. Idol, you'd have the talent comes on and the judges sit there and you've got to win those judges.
They were really judging.
And generally speaking, there was, you know, three or four people on the panel with one really nasty piece of work, like modeled by Simon Cowell originally, who was going to say just horrible things.
That was their job description. Be the nasty judge.
Be the nasty judge. And there were spin-off side programs like The Worst Auditions and things like that we could all line up. So that was what talent show was. And I didn't want my kids watching that, and I stopped them watching it because even though people might be talking about it, I was thinking, I don't want mockery to be part of what my kids think is an acceptable thing. The Voice comes along, and what happens instead is now we have a format where, if you're unfamiliar with the format of The Voice, the auditioners actually sing in a way that the judges can't see them, so their backs are to the auditioners. So they just judge them on The Voice.
So they're not being rude.
They're not being rude, they just can't see them. And then they turn around if they think it's a great voice, and then if more than one person turns around, what they do is they have to fight, so to speak, not physically, but just, you know, fight to convince the person that they can help them and they will help them.
Oh, the judge appeals to them.
So now it's actually the judge playing the role of the person saying, rather than let me tear you down, I want to help you. I'm actually here for you. Let me do the best I can. And so the whole series is built on these judges really putting their fame, their connections and things like that online and saying, how can I make you a better person? What can I do to lift you up rather than what can I do to sit in judgment?
And you find that watchable week in, week out. I've only seen a few moments of the show. Some of the cornballness of it gets to me a bit. Some of the judges seem like they have to react in particular ways when they're on camera and they've got Delta Goodrum seems to be dancing all the time in their seat, and also they have to say those lines to do, like we heard in the clip, that stuff about that was raw, man, and real, and honesty, and thanks for bringing it, and live your dream. Does that get a little bit sickening?
You don't go to musicians for great insights into life, okay? If you don't believe me, just read the average lyric, okay? We're not really looking for great insights. But that said, there is a certain sort of, I used the word earlier, wholesomeness about it, which actually makes it easy to watch.
Okay.
And it is a bit of horse race mentality. You know, you do get your favorites, and so you watch and see if they progress. And you get excited, and you even go as far as to spend money with the kids, you know, texting to vote. You know, so you get into
Mate.
It. I like it because it's something that it's one of those happy mediums that everybody can get behind. It's not my favorite program on TV, but at what it does do is it allows me to easily watch and participate. Now, let's not underestimate this. TV viewing can actually become a really isolating thing. You know, people can get their own particular tastes, and with the versatility of screens these days, kids can be watching something really quite separate to you, even if you only have one TV in the house. Somebody else can still be watching an iPad, a phone, or something like that, or the computer. I like it when we're all in the room enjoying that sort of thing together. So I think it's something worth cultivating.
What do you reckon a Christian can take from The Voice?
I think one of the things that we've got to remember, and I love this, please forgive me if you think this is a long stretch, but I actually think that some people...
I'll be the judge of that.
Thank you. I believe that, but a supportive judge, I hope. Yeah. I believe that some people actually see God in relationship to quiz shows. And follow this analogy.
Talent shows, you mean?
Talent shows, yeah.
Yeah.
Most people look at it as if somehow... You know, there's a cosmic game of the idol going on. You know, there they are, and what they've got to do, they've got to impress God, and God is incredibly critical. And if they somehow, you know, they do well enough, they'll be able to squeeze through to the next round, which happens to be heaven, and they'll be okay. You know,
but pretty much fearing that God is the nasty
God
judge.
God is against them, you know, and that's why I think wholesale, a lot of people have rejected religion in Australia, because I think that they've basically gone, I cannot battle this. I don't want to battle this. Why would God is Simon Cowell written large in the sky, okay? But actually, the truth is that God is much more like one of the judges from The Voice. You know, God is actually saying, I can take you on. You are a project. You need help, and I know how to take you through to the best person you can be. You know, and I like looking at that. I like my kids to
wow,
see.
Wow, this is what you're thinking about at 7 o'clock on a Sunday night as the kids are texting in their favorites and you're singing along to the tunes?
I think that building up your approach to life is an incremental thing. So there's lots of little things you want to place around your kids and lots of little things you want to think about. So I don't shame away from the fact that, say, the kids, you know, do you think God is more like this or more like that? I want them to be thinking about God in relationship to everything they see. And even if they're not thinking, I'm building up a background picture about what I think is wholesome, and so that they can value that later, so that they can recognize it. Because so much about being a Christian parent is about putting things in front of your children that have the savor of heaven, the smell of heaven, so that when heaven is right in front of them, they can recognize it for what it is.
So what your kids are watching, and also what Mark is watching and many other adults out there are watching, is The Voice. It airs on Sundays at 7 p.m. nationally on the Nine Network. It's rated PG for pretty good, according to Mark.
Yeah, I wrote that.
And many other fans out there. All right, so that's on the small screens around the place.
Just quickly, though,
yes?
You've got something coming up in Insights about community too? Because, I mean, I guess we're talking about people getting together.
Oh, yeah, we were talking about people. We were definitely talking about people getting together. Insights, one of the supporters of our show. If you go to insights.uca.org.au, you can check out a new article that's up on there called 5 Steps to Turn Concerns into Actions. It's a piece that's about helping people respond to that feeling you get inside when you think something there's injustice around, or you feel real compassion towards something, but you feel so overwhelmed by what's out there, you don't do anything. So here are five really helpful steps to turn those concerns you have into action.
Stopping that paralysis.
So go to insights.uca.org.au.
Okay, well, we know what the kids are watching this week. What will you be watching on film, Ben?
Mate, well, we've talked about Southpaw and we've mentioned Vacation in the show as well. Also coming up at cinemas this week, once I get my notes up in front of me, which are like moments away, Mark. They're so close. I can taste it and they're here. They're here this week at cinemas.
I saw them enter.
Have you seen Hitman Agent 47?
I haven't, and I'm actually interested.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm a bit of a fan of the comic book to film genre, and so
even though often they're really not good.
Yeah, I'm a sucker.
Right, but this is another video game adaptation. This was tried in 2007. There was a Hitman movie with Timothy Oliphant. Didn't go so well. I'm unlikely to go and see Hitman Agent 47, which has got nothing to do with that other Hitman movie. I think they're trying to reboot something that, whether they need to reboot it, I'm not sure. There's another film around called Dope, which is about youngsters in LA. It sounds like a nerd trio in LA, in a really impoverished area of LA, trying to rise up. It's a coming-of-age story, out of the ghetto, see where they're going to get to. Apparently, it's got a fantastic soundtrack, some interesting performances at the center of it. So I'm kind of curious about Dope. I think I might go check it out. What I have seen that's also out of cinemas this week is Irrational Man, which is the new Woody Allen film. For anyone who doesn't like Woody Allen, there are plenty of people out there that don't.
Is this more like the new Woody Allen or the old Woody Allen?
I think it's more like the old Woody Allen. What I'd say to anyone who doesn't like Woody Allen, think twice about this. Go and check it out, because there's a lot of un-Woody Allen things about Irrational Man. There are plenty of common elements that you usually get. Irrational Man focuses on a philosophy professor played by Joaquin Phoenix, who is so down on life it hurts, until there is this catalyst in his life that actually gives him purpose. But what actually gives
him
purpose?
Not in the form of a young lady, surely.
That's the un-Woody Allen bit about it. Okay. There is a young lady played by Emma Stone in this film She gets involved in his life but doesn't turn his life around like so many other Woody Allen films demonstrate. So while Woody Allen goes into all these philosophical, existential, religious, neurotic diatribes, very well written, very funny, all that happens in Irrational Man, but some of the interesting elements of where this philosophy professor goes to and the critique on the difference between actions and thoughts and whether you can just conceptualize your whole life or whether you can change when you get to situation comes through very strongly in Irrational Man. I really, really liked it.
Wow, you sold me. I'll go.
I've kind of gone off Woody Allen a little bit last couple of years, but I thought Irrational Man's a little bit of a return to form. Very quickly on DVD and Blu-ray this week, that Sean Penn action film The Gunman is out. Don't bother about seeing that.
Save your money.
What you should go and check out, though, is While We're Young, the great Ben Stiller, Naomi Watts comedy drama about intergenerational tension and angst and envy and honesty and where we're at the moment, post-hipster generation.
I hate the conclusion. I love the film.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way, good way to put it. And also, it's the 25th anniversary of Goodfellas. You might want to go and check that out again, that excellent Martin Scorsese crime film. Word of warning, it's not for everybody. Very strong content in shoes, but if you want to watch one of the greatest crime dramas that's ever been committed to cinema, Goodfellas 25th anniversary is out on DVD and Blu-ray.
I can't believe that you've missed the big the Blu-ray DVD release of the week.
There's another one?
Yes. National Lampoon's Vacation is being released on Blu-ray this week.
Thought I might have banged on a little bit too much about that.
And just in case you don't want to pony up the cash, the Nine Network is actually screening it this coming Saturday night.
Or come round to my house and we'll watch it.
Yeah, with the whole family on Skype. Look, there's a lot of other things that are actually turning up on TV this week that are probably worth knowing. There's an interesting one, I think. Look, we'd love to highlight some documentaries every now and again. On the ABC, August 18 this week, Sperm Donors Anonymous. Okay, now, it sounds icky. You'd be going, oh gosh, I'm not sure I really want to watch that. But really, it is a very cautionary and inspiring tale about the effects of anonymous sperm donation, not on just on the donor-conceived children and their families, but on the sperm donors themselves. What sounds like a very altruistic and supportive thing can actually have lots of emotional ramifications for all involved. I think actually that if you're considering that this is something you might support, you know, as a concept, you really should think about this. Have a look at the documentary. Also, thank goodness, they've done a second season of Utopia. I don't know if you saw that, but look.
I saw bits of that. An Australian comedy series.
Yeah, it's
about
great.
Infrastructure and government.
Infrastructure
sounds
and government.
So boring, really funny.
Very, very funny. The second season starts this week on August 19. Well worth, you know, programming.
It's really similar
VCR
to that old ABC series, The Game. The Games, the one about the Olympics, the team organising the Olympics in Sydney. It's very similar to that.
Very similar, but this one is just basically watching bureaucracy eat itself. It's fantastic. Well, basically, that's that for this week. What's coming up next week?
Mate, on next week's show, my goodness, Mark, it's Ladies Week. Next week is Ladies Week.
Oh, we'll be getting the frocks out for this one.
It'll be Ladies and Us. It's the Big Picture Power Women edition. So we're going to be featuring girls just wanting to have fun. Meryl Streep's going to show up.
I'll be wearing padded shoulders.
But you're not the actual women. There will be actual women telling us what they think about movies. And also Meryl Streep's going to show up.
Meryl Streep.
I think Meryl Streep also might be there.
Well, that would be excellent.
I'm not Meryl Streep. I'm Ben McKechnie.
I'm still Mark Hadley.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production and part of Hope 103.2's family of podcasts and vodcasts.